This is an ABC podcast.
Tala for lover and welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Talia Olatia. Today, May 21st, is Global Accessibility Awareness Day, a day which seeks to get people talking, thinking and learning about digital accessibility and inclusions for persons with a disability. So, I'll be taking a look at the accessibility challenges facing persons with a disability in Vanuatu and Fiji, especially during this global pandemic and in the aftermath of Cyclone Harold.
The accessibility of communications, there's communications breakdown everywhere, and even in our office we don't have any electricity, we don't have any internet, Wi-Fi, and it's really a barrier for people with disabilities.
And back in 2006 in Papua New Guinea, Australian pilot Bruce Towers was left a quadriplegic after a deadly helicopter crash. 14 years later, he's been awarded $5.6 million Australian dollars in damages, but now his PNG employer, Heavylift, is appealing that ruling, and Bruce says he feels as though he's been treated as an enemy.
Now I'm a C5-6 quadriplegic. I can't move too much. You know, like I try to do as much as I can. This has really been the salt in the wound.
And the cancellation of Fiji's Kiviti Silk Tails debut season in the New South Wales Rugby League competition may actually reap long-term benefits for the sport in Fiji, with the money that would have gone into the season now being redirected to development programs in Fiji.
I'd like to see more local boys involved in those squads. It's always growing, the number of Fijians playing in the NRL. But if we can create a fresh environment and upskill these boys, be the best they can, then play well for the Silk Tails, it puts them in the window for budget selection down the track.
Those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat. But next, New Zealand's Minister for Pacific Peoples, Opito Williams-Seo.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The Minister for Pacific Peoples in the New Zealand government says Pacifica people shouldn't fear being targeted while the police continue to hold special powers during the COVID-19 emergency. As evidence of government goodwill, the Minister, Opito Williams-Seo, points to special funding for Pacifica communities in the recent budget, and he says formal and informal talks are continuing about reopening travel links. However, there's been widespread outrage on social media at the prospect of police still being able to search homes without a warrant, even though the coronavirus alert level has been scaled back. And speaking to Richard Ewart, the minister says he can identify with the community's anxieties.
I have been receiving that feedback and I'm not concerned. Social media has suddenly taken up a surge in interest in promoting news. But I do understand the concerns that have been raised. I'm a child of the Dawn Raids. I was stopped and roughed up by police as a teenager. Our house was raided in the early hours with police dogs in our faces. So I haven't forgotten that. And in the political arena, that's been used to invoke some concerns here. But I have said this and I will repeat it. That was a different time. And I would hope that we as a country have moved forward. We need to continue the fight against COVID-19. Police and the health ministry do require enforcement powers, particularly if there is an outbreak. We need police to have those powers to be able to disperse, bring events to a closure. And I just ask people, look at the evidence under level 4 and alert level 3. None of the concerns that have now been raised by my political opposition has really panned out.
There was a specific allocation of funds that came out of the budget targeting Pacifica communities, which would tend to suggest perhaps that maybe they have been affected disproportionately for a number of reasons by the COVID-19 emergency. I mean, would you agree?
My experience has been that whenever there's an economic downturn, the Pacifica community of Aotearoa are always the one that get hit the hardest first and has always been the ones that are slow to recover because it does impact jobs, it does impact businesses. And there is recognition by this government that we do need to target some of our responses, target some of our efforts for employment and business recovery, and we're still continuing to work in in that space, because if we don't provide that targeted support, then we may end up being left behind. And so there's $195 million allocation that's tagged Pacific, and that just helps us focus on skills development, more educational wraparound support, as well as business and other support. We have found that through COVID-19, our commitment and our policy on valuing Pacific languages and cultures, we have now found that by us translating all our COVID-19 safety messages in 9 different Pacific languages, that has actually contributed to keeping everybody safe. And the fact that Pacific, of all the population cohorts in New Zealand, has the highest rate of testing of 46 per 1,000, that has been also a sign that our messages using Pacific languages has contributed to keeping everybody safe. And so we're going to continue that work in Budget 2020.
What about getting the Pacifica community moving again? By that, I mean the opportunity for them to go back and visit family in the islands. I mean, currently there is talk of a trans-Tasman travel bubble opening up the links between Australia and New Zealand. The Pacific Islands clearly have indicated that they would like to be involved, but there's a certain amount of reticence, not least from your own Prime Minister, who's expressed concern at not wanting to take COVID-19 into those islands that currently don't have it.
And that's a fair point. The Deputy Prime Minister has been talking to his counterparts, not only worldwide, but also to the Pacific leadership. I've been involved in informal discussions with my political colleagues and other friends, and this is being raised. The borders have begun to open up. Samoa will have its first flight back from New Zealand to Apia on the 22nd of this month, and that will return Samoan citizens who are here, students and others. But the one thing that has been raise is whilst the Pacific do want to be part of this, and obviously tourism is one of the biggest contributors to their local GDPs, the discussion has been about how do we do that while keeping everybody safe. And so I think New Zealand and Australia, their officials have got to work through that and at some stage make a decision about opening up the borders between New Zealand and Australia. And then we need to look about how do we do that safely with the interest that have been expressed by a number of Pacific Island countries. There's also been discussion by Pacific Island nations, albeit in my level has been informal, about a range of things, because it's not just about tourism and trying to revive that sector. Another contributor to the local Pacific GDPs is remittances and infrastructure, sports and aid. And so there's a number of areas that people have been looking at. Fiji, of course, they've been quite adamant they want to be part of that, but they've got COVID-19 cases. Then you've got the Realm Island countries of the Cook Island, Niue and Tokelau that have no COVID-19. Samoa is still fresh in their mind what happened during the measles outbreak. And when they pointed the finger that it was one of the Samoan diaspora that took measles to Samoa, you know, those things are still fresh in our minds. There is a duty of care that's been expressed by our Prime Minister, which we in the New Zealand government support, about making sure that whatever movements that we make, we're able to do it safely, but in consultation and with the agreement of the Pacific countries.
That was New Zealand's Minister for Pacific Peoples, Opito Williams-Seo, and he was talking to Richard Hewitt.
Coronavirus ME1 planuplovirus of binetang ways have come up in sick one kind of sick flu. And we can come up in bagara plong on lapun, or line of city got sick penis. Here I'm sample something where you can make him long stopping round long display sick. Washing one blong you want them soap mark long 20 seconds, stop long way long online, no can go round long all public place, no can all him eye, nose, no mouse blong you. Na time you like kus he gonna set long hand blong you. Suppose you pan him heart long pulling wind, go long out sick or else center close to long you na kiss him help him.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. An Australian pilot who was left a quadriplegic after a deadly helicopter crash in Papua New Guinea more than 14 years ago says he feels he's been treated like an enemy by his former employer. At the time of the crash, Bruce Towers was flying for Heavylift, a PNG aviation company that works primarily with resource companies. After a prolonged legal battle, he was recently awarded $5.6 million Australian dollars in damages after a court found that his employers had failed to warn him about weather conditions or provide appropriate flight instruments. But as Catherine Grau discovered, heavy lift is appealing, and so Bruce Towers' fight for compensation is far from over.
I was born in Port Moresby on the 27th of September 1950. My brother and myself were both born up there, and we spent most of our early life up there before we went to boarding school in Brisbane back in the 60s.
Bruce Towers clearly has a long connection to PNG. It's also a country that's considered to be one of the most challenging and dangerous places to be a pilot. So was that where his passion for flying began?
My father started flying back in the 60s and the 70s. He was involved in theatres, picture theatres, between Madang, Popondetta and Moresby. And we used to take the film stock and stuff for the company from A to B in that time. We used to use aircraft, and I sort of got into flying, but the love that really got me was I got into parachuting in 1969. I used to fly parachuting aircraft as well as jump. I had always a love for helicopters, and I got into helicopters in 1990, went on from there. And I just wanted to fly back in New Guinea, and that's how I got a job with Heavy Lift. I applied and went through the hoops, and then they said, yeah, all right, you come up here and we'll start you through the check and training, which I did, which was very intensive. And it went on from there. And so as soon as I was through, I was put straight to line and I started working for Oil Search down at Sisabia, down in, on the Lake Morrow area. And that's where I got caught one afternoon in the cloud.
That afternoon changed your life forever. For those who don't know the details of your crash back in 2006 that left you unable to walk and tragically three people died in it, can you tell us what happened?
Well, the thing was, I was transporting oil workers, Wantorks, back from their sites. I'd take them out in the mornings and bring them home at night. I'd been on the third trip. The weather always is changeable. So even in 5 minutes, you think that it, you know, it could be there. And there was cloud in the area. And they say that they advised me on the radio that there was fog in the area. But sometimes with radios next to mountains, you don't get all of the conversation. It's sort of like a breakup of a mobile phone. This phenomenon that I got up there, and I've been in the whiteouts and everything in Antarctica, but all of a sudden, the cooling of the atmosphere, and because it was 100% humidity, it just went into sheer thick cloud. And that's what got me. And this particular helicopter that I was using had bat's bear instrumentation in it for flight. Normally, they'll have an artificial horizon, which is a gyro instrument. If you've got one of those, you can fly in cloud, no trouble at all. I can fly in cloud, but the trouble is you need these gyro-based instruments in the helicopter to do it. I had none. I never intended to go into cloud, but I got caught in this cloud. And the only thing I tried to do was slow right down and walk the helicopter down the side of the mountain. I had the trees, which were 50-metre high trees, right outside my door. I didn't have a door on at the time because we used to fly without the door during the day. I just had the tops of the trees to give me the horizon and down. And I must have chipped a blade or something like that, or the back tail rotor, and down through the trees we went 150 feet, banging. And the fact that any of us survived, I don't know why, but I'm really sort of down and out that three gentlemen, two on impact, were killed, and a third gentleman died with me on the way to Moresby.
Bruce Towers' case has been in and out of the courts over the years. He'd sued his employer Heavy Lift for damages in negligence. And in 2016, an Australian court found the company had failed to provide Mr. Towers with proper flying instruments and adequate training. Just last month, an Australian judge ordered Heavy Lift to pay Mr. Towers just over $5.6 million Australian dollars in damages. But the company is now appealing that. Not to have the total amount thrown out, but it is just requesting to pay nearly $1 million less in compensation. It argues the trial judge didn't get it right in terms of the life expectancy for Mr. Towers.
All of the way I've been fought at, and it's just been pretty hard, and this has really knocked the sale out, because I thought that after the winning of the court case and an appeal that we won that, most of my medical bills and loss of work and things like that, and now I'm a C5-6 quadriplegic. I can't move too much. You know, like I try to do as much as I can. This has really been the salt in the wound.
And you say the pilots and PNG are backing you in this legal fight, and that if you were ever to return to PNG, the beers would be on them. Why is that? Is this more than a fight just for yourself?
That's a sort of a word that I've heard through the grapevine. You know, pilots, we all talk. While everything's going, everything's rosy. But as soon as something breaks down and somebody gets injured or something of that nature, and it's a fight to get some compensation, that's when it really hurts, that you've got to sort of work. And the fact that I've spent 14 years so far on this case, and people said, geez, Towers, you've got a lot of guts to keep going. I said, well, we're just doing what we think is right.
That was former Heavy Lift helicopter pilot Bruce Towers speaking there to Catherine Grau. And the legal team for Heavy Lift says they won't be commenting on their reasons for seeking reduced damages, as the appeal is still before the court. Time now for a weather update. Neville Coop is the director of Nandraki Weather and joins us. Good morning, Neville.
Yeah, hi, Talia.
How's it looking in the region today, Neville?
Yeah, look, it's been very bland and boring for quite some time now. There's not much going on. We do have a low pressure system that's developed over in the last 24 hours near the Kermadec Islands, just about halfway between Fiji and New Zealand. And that low has a frontal system, and that's scraping by the islands of the Kingdom of Tonga and the Cook Islands and Niue. Not much in it, really, mostly just cloud, but perhaps a few showers. Most of the population centres, certainly around Melanesia, are going to be fine on sunny today. And also for the atolls to the north, which have actually in quite a dry spell at the moment. So Tuvalu, Kiribati and Tokelau are being dry now for some time. So a bit of weather just to the north of the equator, but that's really just a few clusters of thunderstorms here and there. And at the moment, we do have a bit of weather around Pohnpei and Cross Rae in the Micronesian Islands. But all attention on, weather-wise at least, today is on a very strong tropical cyclone in the Bay of Bengal, which is making landfall as we speak across the northern end of the Bay of Bengal.
And the severity of that system in the Bay of Bengal?
So it has weakened as it's moved north, but it is still probably a Category 2 hurricane. It's moved over slightly cooler waters now as it's moving north. It is fairly early in the season in the northern hemisphere, so the waters haven't warmed up yet, but it's still a very powerful system with winds upwards of 180 kilometres per hour near the centre in gusts. But certainly also, if anyone's familiar with that part of the world, the very flat delta region of the Ganges and other rivers which drain from the Himalayas into the Bay of Bengal, it's very flat and featureless around there. So storm surge and coastal flooding is a big risk.
Absolutely, and especially during this global pandemic with large populations in India and Bangladesh, it's no doubt not going to be a good time.
No, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. Neville, thank you so much for the update this morning.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you. That was Neville Coop there. He is the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can always visit their Facebook page. You'll find them at Nandraki Weather.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Do you know what I was thinking last night? I was thinking, we don't play enough Tupac music on ABC Radio, and because I get to control the music, I get to change that when I think of those things. This is one of my favourite Tupac songs. This is Keep Your Head Up.
Something for my godson Elijah and a little girl named Corinne. Some say the blacker the better, the sweeter the juice. I say the darker the flesh and the deeper the roots. I give a holler to my sister's own welfare. Kids, if don't nobody else care. And I know they like to beat you down a lot. When you come around the block, brothers clown a lot. But please don't cry, dry your eyes, never let up. Forgive but don't forget, girl, keep your head up. And when he tells you you ain't nothing, don't believe him. And if you can't learn to love you, you should leave him. Cause sister, you don't need him. And I ain't trying to gas you up, I just call him how I see. You know what makes me unhappy? That when brothers make babies and leave a young mother to be a pet. And since we all came from a woman, got our name from a woman, and I came from a woman. I wonder why we take from our women, why we rape our women, do we hate our women? I think it's time to kill for our women, time to heal our women, be real to our women. And if we don't, we'll have a race of babies that will hate the ladies that make the babies. And since a man can't make one, he has no right to tell a woman when and where to create one. So will the real men get up? I know you're fed up, ladies, but keep your head up. I remember Marvin Gaye used to sing to me. He had me feeling like black was the thing to be. And suddenly the ghetto didn't seem so tough. And though we had it rough, we always had enough. I hopped up off about my curfew and broke the rules. Ran with the local crew and had a smoke or two. I realized mama really paid the price. She nearly gave her life to raise me right. And all I had to give her was my pipe dream. I holler out the mic and make it to the right screen. I'm trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. It's hard to be legit and still pay your rent. And in the end, it seems I'm heading for the pen. I try to find my friends, but they're blowing in the wind. Last night, my buddy lost his whole family. It's gonna take the man in me to conquer this insanity. It seems the rain will never let up. I try to keep my head up and still keep from getting wetter. You know it's funny when it rains, it pours. They got money for wars, but can't feed the poor. Said it ain't no hope for the youth. It ain't no hope for the future. And then they wonder why we crazy. I blame my mother for turning my brother into a crack baby. We ain't meant to survive cause it's a setup. And even though you're fed up, you got to your head. On their own. I know it's kind of rough and you're feeling all alone. Daddy's long gone and he left you by your lonesome. Thanks the Lord for my kids, even if nobody else want them. Cause I think we can make it, in fact, I'm sure. And if you fall, stand tall or come back for more. Cause ain't nothing worse than when your son wants to know why his daddy don't love him no more. You can't complain, you was dealt this hell of a hand without a man feeling helpless. Because there's too many things for you to. Inside, but outside you're looking fierce. While the tears is rolling down your cheek, your daddy hoping things don't all fall this week. Cause if it did, you couldn't take it. And don't blame me, I was given this world, I didn't make it. And now my son's getting older and cold from having the world
to keep your head up.
A song from 1993. That was Keep Your Head Up by Tupac, with messages that I still think are relevant in 2020, especially that of, you know, things get bad, but just keep your head up.
Foreman, hold the front page!
Time now to find out the stories making news around the region. And to do that, I'm joined by Marla Damati. Good morning, Marla.
Good morning.
Firstly, Tuvalu's Prime Minister has called for unity in fighting COVID-19. What's he had to say?
Well, Tuvalu's Prime Minister, Kaseya Natano, who is also the Pacific Island Forum Chair, spoke at the annual World Health Assembly overnight. Now, Mr. Natano pointed to the Pacific countries working together and opening a shared response resource pathway to keep the virus out of the region. He said that the COVID-19 pandemic is both a global health emergency and a human crisis that impacts our livelihoods and deepens mistrust around the world. Now, he did go on to say that during this pandemic, we are learning that the virus does not respect international borders. We are all vulnerable, and that shared vulnerability reveals common humanity, which is a lovely sentiment, and it is very true. Now, the Tuvalu Prime Minister also called for Taiwan to be included in the World Health Organization, a move supported by the US, Australia and New Zealand, which has obviously angered China. Now, I do want to note as well that Tuvalu recognizes Taipei over Beijing, so it's understandable that the Tuvaluan Prime Minister is calling for the WHO to recognize Taiwan in its sort of collection.
Yeah, absolutely. And using his platform at the World Health Assembly to advocate for their position at the World Health Organization as well. I'm sure the people over in Taiwan were like, thank you, Tuvalu Prime Minister, thanks for that. Good note. Marla, let's go now to a report that's been released, which states that global CO2 emissions could fall by up to 7% this year because of the pandemic. What is this research saying?
Well, global carbon dioxide emissions, like you said, could fall up to 7% this year, but that's dependent on ongoing restrictions and social distancing measures during this coronavirus pandemic. And this was in research published in the journal Nature Climate Change. Now, the study is done by a group of scientists from institutions in Europe, the United States and Australia. What they did was they analysed CO2 emissions across 69 countries, 50 US states, 30 Chinese provinces and 6 economic sectors, using data from daily electricity use and mobility tracking services. Now, in 2019, the world emitted around 100 million tonnes of carbon dioxide per day by burning fossil fuels and cement production. This is what the researchers said. That's a lot.
It's funny because you said carbon dioxide and 100 million tonnes. And I know that, you know, humans, when they breathe out, they emit carbon dioxide. And I was like, oh, that's a lot of breathing. But obviously burning fossil fuels is probably the larger contributor.
You can continue to breathe. That's
yeah,
fine.
Keep doing that.
It's the other things, like you said, burning fossil fuels and cement production. Now, in early April 2020, emissions actually fell to 83 million tonnes per day, which is a drop of 17%. Mm. Pretty significant.
Yeah.
And in even some countries, it dropped by as much as 26% on average during the peak of, you know, when you were confined to stay at home, the stay at home lockdown laws. Now, if pre-pandemic conditions return by mid-June, so we all go back to normal, now the 2020 emissions could decline by 4% compared to the 2019 emissions data. But if restrictions remain worldwide until the end of the year, so the lockdown laws, the stay-at-home laws, then emissions could actually drop by 7%, which is what the report said. Now, the lead author of the study said that population confinement has led to drastic changes in energy use and CO2 emissions. I know that, you know, even though I'm driving into work, I'm using my car less, you know, I am just using sort of less things that I would in a normal circumstance.
Yep.
I know my partner hasn't driven his car in a long time because he just doesn't need to because he is working from home. Look, the lead author also did say that these extreme decreases are likely to be temporary. However, they do not reflect the structural changes in the economic, transport or energy sectors. And, you know, I think it also is a reminder not to be complacent, that we should, you know, when things do go back to normal, try to live a little bit more less CO2 eco-friendly way of, you know, living.
Environmentally conscious kind of way. Because I think it's proven that we can
live lives and life will still go on without us getting in our car instead of like walking to where something is and making those kind of choices.
And also the decrease in flights is a really big contributor, I think, to that CO2 emissions is that, you know, a lot of flights have been stopped from country to country and flights do make up a large portion of CO2 emissions in, you know, in the scheme of things. So I think by planes being grounded, it's also made a massive impact as well.
I know you say all the good things, but I'm still like just itching to get back to Tasmania. And I'm sure there are a lot of people who are just wanting to get on a plane and go home to their family. So, I mean, after I do that, then we'll focus on the environment. We're a complex people. Finally, Marla, a heartwarming video has gone viral showing Samoan twins shaving their heads. So what had happened is one of them had cancer and the other one shaved their head in solidarity. Tell me more.
Well, it is such a beautiful video. And I watched it myself. Now, the moving video was shared of an Auckland woman shaving her head in solidarity with her twin sister, who is currently undergoing treatment for leukemia. Now, Samoan twins Joella and Joanna Lilu shaved their heads as they were surrounded by family in the video that was posted to Facebook on the weekend. Joella wrote that today Joanna decided to show how brave and strong she was by shaving her head so treatments could be easier. But she went on to say that I couldn't let her go through with it alone, so I decided we'll do it together, just like everything else we've done together in life. It was beautiful. I cried when I was even just watching it.
I'm tearing up thinking about it.
Yeah. Now, Joanna was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia cancer on the 6th of April and has been receiving chemotherapy during the COVID-19 pandemic. And her twin sister, Joella, posted the video on Facebook. And she also wrote, as devastating as the news was, my sister had to start her treatment straight away. But because of lockdown, she had to do it all alone in a hospital without her family there to hold her hand and wipe away her tears when she needed it. Now, it's a hard time for my family, but especially for my sister. In a more positive light, the Facebook post has now received more than 12 million views, 151,000 comments, and 450,000 shares from people all over the world sharing prayers for Joanna and her family and sending their well wishes. Mm. So, you know, we also send her all the best and hopefully she can get through this. But I watched the video. I cried. Like, it was just
beautiful.
It's beautiful. So if you do have a chance, I would definitely go into your search engines and type in Joella and Joanna Lilo, and you can see the video. But it is just showing the strength of, you know, sisters and
family. And also twins as well. Twins always fascinate me. My brothers are twins. I've got twin cousins on both sides of the family. Like, twins just run in our family. And it must have been so hard for Joella to watch her twin sister go through something like this, because twins, you know, for the longest time, they do everything together. Even when they are separate and they live their own lives, like my twins, like they're mine. But Daniel and JP are like chalk and cheese, but they're still, that twin connection is undeniable. So how hard it must be to watch a sibling, but also your twin go through something like this, especially during a global pandemic where you have to be alone. Like, it's such a beautiful gesture to show, you know, and especially hair too. Like,
hair is so important to many people, but especially, you know.
Yeah, I'd be so devastated if I had to cut my hair, like shave my hair. So just that scene of solidarity within the siblings is just so, so beautiful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I do encourage people. It's like, if you want to feel good, but it's not, it's heartwarming, but it's also really sad, but it's also uplifting. It's a complex array of emotions.
If you want to feel roller coaster of emotions, please watch the video.
Just maybe have some tissues ready and someone who can give you a hug afterwards, provided that, you know, social distancing and all that other stuff, make sure it's safe, but also look after yourself. Marla, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
My pleasure.
That was Marla Damati there with just some of the stories making news today. Next, we're going to have a look at Global Accessibility Awareness Day.
ABC Radio Australia. Join Andrew West for the Religion and Ethics Report.
A survey of more than 1,000 Australians has found that almost 80% of you believe respect for a person's religious beliefs is important in a multicultural society.
What we found overall is that Australians have a relatively positive attitude towards religion. They think that religion should be respected in a multicultural society, but where we found the key tension was that Australians seem to be viewing religious individuals and religious organisations separately. So they're happy for religious people to say their religious beliefs in public, even when they're offensive, but they're unsure about religious organisations hiring according to their faith. And that is the key tension that we found.
The Religion and Ethics Report, Wednesday evening, 5:30 PNG time, and Thursday afternoon after Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. We can all agree that everyone should be treated equally and fairly and have the same opportunities. However, for persons with a disability, this is not always the case. Many products, devices, services and environments are not accessible for persons with a disability. And it's made even harder when dealing with world events like COVID-19 or severe weather systems like Cyclone Harold. Today, May 21st, is Global Accessibility Awareness Day. And so I took a look at the current accessibility challenges facing persons with disabilities in Vanuatu and Fiji.
Everyone is different. We live, work, play, and interact in our own individual ways. Don't cut someone out just because you haven't prepared for the way they might interact with your creation. Make it easy. This is what being inclusive is about.
Global Accessibility Awareness Day seeks to get everyone talking, thinking and learning about digital access and inclusion for the more than 1 billion people with disabilities and impairments around the world. For persons with a disability in the Pacific, the global pandemic and Cyclone Harold have really highlighted just how important accessibility is. Oh, can you hear me?
I'll squat outside. Maybe I can hear you properly. Hello?
Hello, I can still hear you.
Hello?
Yes, yep.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Sorry, I think we've been having problems with the internet. Oh. I mean, with the coverage, and it wasn't really clear.
That is Nellie Caleb. She is the National Coordinator of Vanuatu's Disability Promotion and Advocacy Association. As you can hear, accessibility to services after Cyclone Harold has been difficult for the people of Vanuatu, but it's been even harder for persons with a disability.
The accessibility of communications, there's communications breakdown everywhere, and even in our office we don't have any electricity, as well as we don't have any internet, Wi-Fi, and it's really a barrier for people with disabilities. In Vanuatu, if there's any cyclone warnings, people who are deaf cannot listen to radio, or even cannot the blind people cannot access information from the text messages. So it's really hard.
Meanwhile, in Fiji, Lanieta Tuimambo, who is the office manager for Fiji's Disabled People's Federation, says the global pandemic highlights the barriers for persons with a disability to access important and often life-saving information.
A lot of challenges that are faced by persons with disabilities draws around access to information and communication and the clear messaging specifically going out to persons with disability regarding their safety and their protection, how they can prepare themselves, and also the general information that are going out is not really reaching those with disabilities in an accessible format.
Nellie Caleb in Vanuatu again.
People who are deaf are so lucky, some family members who can interpret for them, but most of them don't know what they're saying, they're doing, this is going around and shouting, talking about, prevention measures, but our members cannot access this information.
In Fiji, persons with a disability are more likely to be unemployed, poor, and live in overpopulated areas with poor living conditions. Lanieta Tuimambo says the job losses and reduction of hours associated with the global pandemic has exacerbated the problems persons with a disability face.
Some have reduced hours and some just totally lost their jobs. I think the other critical area is the food security on a daily basis because they have lost their jobs, less income. But we would say that already people with disability are disadvantaged in that case.
In Vanuatu, Nellie Caleb says they are working with the government to ensure that persons with a disability are not left behind in the relief efforts.
We are partnering with the Vanuatu Society for People with Disabilities and also the Ministry of Justice. We have joined efforts to come up collecting validation data for people with disabilities. This is to ensure that people with disabilities are not left behind in relief supplies or in any other responses. With the work that we are doing, we make sure that people with disabilities are not left behind.
Despite the challenges persons with a disability face, Fiji's Lanietta Tuimambo is optimistic that change will happen as long as everyone works together.
We can only do that working together with persons with disabilities and their disabled people's organizations to ensure that all these services of people with disability and we are not discriminated against.
And it's a hope that is shared by Nelly Caleb in Vanuatu as well.
It's changing because I remember in 2015 when I was advocating for inclusion of people with disabilities in different class, there was nobody there and they didn't know what I'm saying. So I could see the stage changes, big changes happening.
That was Nelly Caleb, the National Coordinator of Vanuatu Disability Promotion and Advocacy Association. And you also heard from Lanietta Tuimambo, who is the Office Manager for Fiji's Disabled People's Federation.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The cancellation of the Cavite Silk Tails debut season in the New South Wales Rugby League competition may actually reap long-term benefits for the sport in Fiji. The money set aside to run the brand new club is being redirected into an expanded development program. As Richard Ewart reports, the hope is the investment in high performance will produce more players who meet the standards required to play in the local league, for the Silk Tails, and then eventually in the Super League and the NRL.
The cash windfall for Fiji is the result of the coronavirus pandemic, which put a stop to the Silk Tails season after just one match, and now their funds are being spent on upgrading and fitting out three development centres in different parts of the country. Chief Executive Petro Sivanasiva says more and better training facilities will help to raise standards and enlarge the player pool from which the next Silk Tails squad will be chosen.
We've established our Silk Tails Centre of Excellence in Lotoka, which is a fantastic three-storey facility. It has our gymnasium, high-performance unit downstairs, our residence for their players, and we also secured the third level, which will be our office space. We also lease desks to the Fiji NRL. It gives us a wonderful rugby league presence in the west, in Lotoka. On the back of that, we are going to look at updating the gym at the Suva FNRL head office. We've just purchased some new equipment for Silk Tails Elite Pathway Development players in the Suva region. They can train out of that facility. And also we're looking to establish another high-performance unit for our elite player development players in Singatoka.
At the heart of these new development plans is the former Fijibati and Newcastle Knights captain Wes Nagama, who is now the Silk Tails coach and head of high performance. He hopes the investment at the grassroots will generate a new generation of players from the islands who are good enough to represent their country.
100%, mate. We're affiliated with FNRL and working closely with them. And Brendan Costin's the national coach, so we're working with him. We're trying to always identify the best players to put in the Silk Tails program. Come World Cup years and Test matches end of the year, you'd like to see more local boys involved in those squads. It's always growing, the number of Fijians playing in the NRL. But if we can create a fresh environment and upskill these boys, be the best they can, they can play well for the Silk Tails, it puts them in the window for budget selection down the track.
The program for the Silk Tails is going to be quite extensive, and now having established these three training bases for local players, we've got plans to establish more centres around the country. Nothing like this has come into Fiji before. That's why the FNRL, their CEO and chairman and board, were really, really happy with our decision to do this.
Sivanasiva says the pathways that can be created through the new development plan can be life-changing for male and female players alike.
It's all about giving opportunities to local kids, local players, you know, who are dreaming big of finding their way in life through this wonderful platform of our sport, rugby league. But we're not stopping there. Our next goal is to establish a foothold within our women's ranks as well. And we'll work closely with the FNRL in looking at pathways for our schoolgirls and our women's rugby league program as well.
Down the track, I'd love to coach at the highest level, whether that be at NRL or one day coach the Bati side. That's always high on the list of my goals, but I'm a long way from there. So I'm just so blessed with this opportunity. This came a lot earlier than I thought, and just the fact that I'm living in Fiji and I'm helping local Fijian boys, it's just a dream big for me.
The development of the women's game in Fiji got off to a flying start when the new national team, the Bulakula, hammered the PNG Orchids and then lost only narrowly to the Australian Prime Minister's 13. Now, the Silktails football manager Jackie Shannon says they'd like to get a national club competition for Fiji off the ground next year.
We were hoping perhaps to start off with a nines competition for women to build up the momentum, given that there being no competition for women this year and in 2018. Most of the girls have opted to go and play the other code, so that's been a challenge for us. But we're working around getting those girls back into league.
The big focus is reaching out to the schools all around Fiji and just exposing them to the game. That's it. So if you can gather the interest of these girls and they want to play rugby league and want to know it, that's a great start. So it definitely starts at grassroots levels, and that's reaching out to schools in the weekend competitions.
It's all about the development pathway and providing those opportunities, inspiring young schoolgirls who are interested in playing elite rugby league, that there's a way in which you can do that. And obviously now that we've got these facilities, we've got the opportunity in Lautoka especially to invite schools teams over to Lautoka to use our centre to train in. We've got the accommodation there as well. So there's some really exciting opportunities. I'm a really big believer in women's sport and women rugby league for sure. There's so much potential within the women's ranks. What that looks like in another 10 years' time, I guess I'm just so excited to think what that could become.
And Jackie Shannon says there's also been talk of a Silktails women's 13, which would play in curtain raiser games before the men's home matches in Lautoka.
I think that is something that Peter Rowe and Stephen Driscoll, our CEO, had in mind. We had planned for this season. I think it is in August. We had planned to have a Silktails women's team come up against the visiting team from Australia. And it is our hope that we will have a Kaviti Silktails women team playing in the Harvey Norman in Australia.
Of more immediate concern to Wes Naigama is the fact that after travelling from Australia, he still has just under half of a 28-day COVID-19 quarantine period to go before he can actually head to Lautoka to start work in earnest.
Oh, yeah, it's tough. I'm just sort of just trying to keep some sort of routine, you know, getting up early out of bed, whether I'm going for a walk or doing a session out in the tennis court area here. And there's still a lot of planning and work going towards this EDP that we're doing. So we're just focusing on that and then obviously trying to train again and just tire myself out again in the afternoon.
Meanwhile, as the battle for control of rugby league in Tonga continues with no end in sight, after a number of clashes during the 6 years it took to bring the Silktails as a club to life, Wes Naigama says they and the Fiji NRL are working in harmony.
It's always evolving and improving. We've got a great relationship with FNRL, chairman, CEO, the board. We're all working together. Whatever the past is in the past, we're definitely growing and trying to move forward. And all I can see is positive signs.
So all the ingredients are there for the Silktails to grow as a club. But while they remain dormant, it seems the money that would have underwritten the team's debut season in the Ron Massey Cup in Australia will be being put to very good alternative uses.
Richard Ewart reporting there on the ambitious plans for growing the game of rugby league in Fiji.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The coronavirus pandemic is hitting economies hard, with experts warning countries across the globe are facing their toughest years on record. To weather the windfall, the tiny Pacific nation of Tuvalu is looking to double down on some of the unusual ways it makes money, including selling designer coins. Just a few weeks ago, it issued a coin of the American film star John Wayne that's now selling for more than $100. Tuvalu's treasury says it hopes to negotiate a better deal with the Australian-based Perth Mint so it can make more money selling coins to international collectors. For more on this story, here's reporter Priyanka Srinivasan.
Tuvalu may be one of the smallest countries in the world, but it has made a big name for itself on the designer coin market. The tiny Pacific nation is known by collectors internationally for its precious metal money. They are often worth 10 times more than their $1 or $2 face value. Mark Nemstis is a coin collector from Australia, and over the years has sold dozens of Tuvalu coins from his Purple Penny coin store.
They've proven very popular over the years. The most popular one is probably the 2006 Redback Spider 1 ounce silver coin, which I think was released for about $80, but these days trades for over $1,000. It's probably their most popular and well-known coin.
In Tuvalu, the Australian dollar is the official currency, while its own coins are designed, crafted, and marketed in Australia. It's part of a decades-old agreement between the Perth Mint, a company owned by the Western Australian government, and Tuvalu. It's contracted to pay Tuvalu a minimum in royalties each year, approximately $200,000. According to the Tuvaluan government. But the coins rarely make it onto Tuvaluan soil themselves. Instead, they are sold to collectors in China, Japan, Germany, and the United States.
It is the 2020 Tuvalu 1 ounce silver, $1 Marvel Series Venom Brilliant Uncirculated Coin. So now the mintage on this is 50,000. 50,000.
For many, collecting 50, coins 000. Is a hobby. For others, it's an investment. Popular coins can be resold for massive profits. And the coins Tuvalu makes aren't your everyday pieces of small change that you carry in your wallet. They are often multicolored, sometimes with holographic emblems, and can be emblazoned with superheroes, Hollywood stars, plants and animals from around the world. Tuvalu is not the only country that sells collectible coins. Cook Islands also has a similar deal with the Perth Mint. But according to coin collector Mr. Nemstis, Tuvalu is the most successful and the most well-known around the world for its unusual coins.
People are quite taken by the designs and quite taken by the quality of the product. Not just the coin, but the packaging and all the material that comes along with them.
Neil Vance is general manager of Perth Mint and says the long-standing agreement with Tuvalu has helped the Pacific country carve out this lucrative niche among traders.
We work with the Ministry of Finance there, and we actually send them submissions of what coins we'd like to mint, and they will approve those submissions. And then we will go ahead and mint them, and the coins will specifically say that they are Tuvalu, which means they are legal tender of Tuvalu, and they will feature Queen Elizabeth because Tuvalu is a Commonwealth country with the Queen as head of state. So collectors do like the fact that coins are legal tender because they feel there's a government backing and the correct amount of metal, etc., is going into the coin. So they feel a lot of comfort with the government-backed product.
Perth Mint is responsible for creating the unique designs. Once approved by the Tuvalu government, the gold or silver is melted down, crafted into discs, and stamped with the designs. The whole process can take months before the coins are ready for the market.
Tuvalu only has a population of about 12,000 people, so they certainly don't have a mint on the island. And in terms of looking for opportunities, we can provide, obviously, a government-backed mint making coins with the Tuvalu legal tender. And obviously, there's a lot of trust between a government-backed mint like ourselves and the government of Tuvalu.
And it's a source of revenue for Tuvalu that could grow. Penny Kaitu is Tuvalu's government accountant, and he says the agreement brings in a small but valuable income.
It's quite a good support for the government in terms of revenue.
And now, with coronavirus affecting the country's revenue, particularly through a loss of tourism and fishing license sales, he says the government is looking to amplify its existing agreement with the Perth Mint.
Probably, I believe there will be a change. A lot of change. They're looking at the dollar value. Yeah? They are concerning about what Tuvalu will receive under the contract.
Instead of the $200,000 promised, Mr. Kaitu says they want Tuvalu's income to be a percentage of total coin sales.
I think that's another one of the major areas that need a revision to the contract.
And it's not just coin sales Tuvalu is looking to ramp up during these difficult times. It has a highly sought-after internet domain name, .tv. Mr. Kaitu says they'll look to renegotiate the multi-million dollar contract with American company VeriSign when it expires next year. That company manages the .tv registry.
As far as I know, we are receiving around $2 million. I think that's the largest investment we have so far. What I heard, they are also reviewing that agreement with the VeriSign.
What comes of those discussions remains to be seen. But as for coin collectors, they continue to eagerly await the next Tuvalu offering via Perth Mint. Here's collector Mark Nemstis again.
You know, the coins that we see in our change, they're mundane, common day items, but they have a lifetime that outlives us as people.
That was coin collector Mark Nemstis ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan. That is all for Pacific Beat for this morning. Don't forget that Catherine Grau will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. So keep listening to ABC Radio Australia. No, you can't just faint here, ABBA. I think it's fitting that we finish today's program with ABBA's Money, Money, Money. Stay safe, and I'll catch you tomorrow for more Pacific Beat.